Chapter 3. Capital World. The Ocean House. Intruders, past and present. Thracian Primaris, capital world of the Helican subsector, seat of government, Helican subsector, Scarus sector, segmentum obscurus. You can read that description in any one of 100,000 guidebooks, geographies, imperial histories, pilgrimage primers, industrial ledgers, trade directories, star maps. It sounds impressive, authoritarian, powerful. It does no justice at all to the monster it describes. I have known hellholes and death planets that from space look serene and wondrous. The watercolors of their atmospheres, the glittering moons and belts they wear like bangles and jewels, the natural wonders that belie the dangers they contain. Thracian Primaris is no such dissembler. From space it glowers like an oozing cataracted eye. It is corpulent, swollen, sheened in gray veils of atmospheric soot, through which the billion-billion lights of the city hives glimmer like rotting stars. It glares balefully at all ships that approach. And oh, but they approach. Shoals of ships, flocks of them, countless craft drawn to this bloated cesspit by the lure of its vast industrial wealth and mercantile vigor. It has no moons, no natural moons, anyway. 5 Ramillies-class starforts hang above its atmosphere, their crenellated towers and buttressed gun stations guarding the approaches to and from the capital world. A dedicated guild of 40,000 skilled pilots exists simply to guide traffic in and out of the jostling, crowded high-anchor reaches. It has a planetary defense force, a standing army of 8 million men. It has a population of 22 billion, plus another billion temporary residents and visitors. 7/10 of its surface are now covered by hive structures, including great sections of the world's original oceans. City sprawl fills and covers the seas, and the waters roll in darkness far beneath. I loathe the place. I loathe the lightless streets, the noise, the press of bodies. I loathe the stink of its recirculated air. I loathe its airborne grease filth adhering to my clothes and skin. But fate and duty bring me back there, time and again. The encrypted inquisitorial missive had been quite clear. I, and a great number of my peers, was summoned to Thracian Primaris to attend the Holy Novena and wait upon the pleasure of the Lord Grandmaster Inquisitor Ubertino Orsini. Orsini was the most senior officer of the Inquisition in the entire Helican subsector, a status that made him equal in rank and power to any Cardinal Palatine. I was not about to decline. The voyage from Lethe 11 took a month, and I brought my entire entourage back with me. We arrived just 4 days shy of the start of the novena. As a tiny pilot boat led my ship into anchor through the massed ranks of orbiting starships, I saw the dark formations of battlefleet Scarus suckling at a starfort as if they were its young. This was their heroic homecoming. There was a taste of victory in the air. An imperial triumph on this scale was something to be savored, something the Ministerium could use to boost the morale of the common citizenry. "Your itinerary has been prepared," said Alain von Beig, a junior interrogator who served as my secretary. "We were aboard the gun cutter, dropping towards the planet." "Oh, by whom?" He paused. Von Beig was a diffident and lusterless young man, who I doubted would ever make the rank of Inquisitor. I'd accepted him to my staff in the hope that service alongside Ravenna might inspire him. It had not. "I would have presumed that the preparation of my itinerary might have included my own choices." Von Beig stammered something. I took the data slate he was holding. The list of appointments was not his handiwork, I saw. It was an official document, processed by the Ministerium's nunciature, in collaboration with the Office of the Inquisition. My timetable for all 9 days of the Holy Novena was filled with audiences, acts of worship, feasts, presentation ceremonies, unveilings, and ministerium rites. All 9 days, plus the days before and after. I was here, damn it. I had responded to the summons. I would not allow myself to be subjected to this round of junkets too. I took a stylus and quickly marked the events I was prepared to attend. The formal rites, the inquisitorial audience, the grand bestowment. "That's it," I said, tossing it back to him. "The rest I'm skipping." Von Beg looked uncomfortable. You are expected at the post-apostolic conclave immediately on arrival. Immediately on arrival, I told him sternly. I'm going home. Home, for me, was the Ocean House, a private residence I leased in the most select quarter of Hive 70. On many Hive worlds, the rich and privileged dwell in districts high up in the topmost city spires, divorced as far as possible from the dirt and crowding of the mid and low Hab levels. But no matter how high you climbed on Thracian Primaris, there was nothing to find but smog and pollution. Instead, the exclusive habitats were on the underside of the Hive portions that extended out over and into the hidden seas. There was at least a tranquility here. Medea Betancourt flew the gun cutter down through the traffic-thick atmosphere, threaded her way between the tawdry domes, dingy towers, rusting masts and crumbling spires, and laced into the seething lanes of air vehicles, entering a vast feeder tunnel which gave access to the Hive's arterial transit network. Bars of blue-white light set into the walls of the huge tunnel strobed by the ports. In under an hour we had reached a great transit hub, 3 kilometres down in the city crust, where she set the cutter down on a massive elevator platform that sedately lowered us and a dozen other craft into the sublevels of Hive 70. The cutter was then berthed in a private lifterdrome, and we transferred to a tube rail for the final stretch to the maritime habitats. I was already weary of Thracian Primaris by the time I reached the Ocean House. Built from plasma-sealed grandiorite and an adamite frame, the Ocean House was one of 1,000 estates built along the submarine wall of Hive 70. It was 9 kilometres beneath the city crust, and another 2 below sea level. A small palace by the standards of most common imperial citizens, it was large enough to house my entire retinue, my libraries, armory, and training facilities, not to mention a private chapel, an audience hall, and an entire annex for Beckwin's distaff. It was also secure, private, and quiet. Yarat, my housekeeper, was waiting for us in the entrance hall. She was dressed, as ever, in a pale grey gown robe and a black lace cap, draped with a white veil. As the great iron hatch doors cycled open, and I breathed the cool, purified air of the house, she clapped her plump hands and sent servitors scurrying forward to take our coats and assist with the baggage train. I stood for a moment on the Nashmeek rug and looked around at the austere stone walls and the high arched roof. There were no paintings, no busts or statuary, no crossed weapons or embroidered tapestries, only an inquisitorial crest on the far wall over the stairs. I am not one for decoration or opulence. I require simple comfort and functionality. The others bustled around me. Beckwin and Amos went through to the library. Ravener and Von Beg issued careful instructions to the servitors concerning some baggage items. Medea disappeared to her private room. The others in my retinue melted away into the house. Yarat greeted them all, and then came to me. "Welcome, sir," she said. "You have long been from us."
16 months, Yarat.
"The house is aired and ready. We made preparations as soon as you signalled your intentions. We were saddened to hear of the losses."
"Anything to report?"
"Security was, of course, double-checked prior to your arrival. There are a number of messages."
"I'll review them shortly."
"You are hungry, no doubt."
She was right, though I hadn't realized it.
"The kitchen is preparing dinner. I took the liberty of selecting a menu that I believe you will approve of."
"As ever, I have faith in your choices, Yarat. I'd like to dine on the sea terrace, with any who would join me."
"I'll see to it, sir. Welcome home."
I bathed, put on a robe of grey wool, and sat for a while alone in my private chambers, sipping a glass of Amasek and looking through the messages and communiques by the soft light of the lamp. There were many, mostly recent postings from old acquaintances, officials, fellow inquisitors, soldiers, alerting me to their arrival on the planet and conveying respects. Few needed more than a form reply from my secretary. To some I penned courteous, personal responses, expressing the hope of meeting them at some or other of the novena's many events. There were 3 that drew my particular attention. The first was a private coded missive from Lord Inquisitor Phlebas Alessandro Rorken. Rorken was the head of Ordo Xenos in the Helican subsector, my immediate superior and part of the triumvirate of senior inquisitors who answered directly to Grandmaster Orsini. Rorken wanted to see me as soon as I was back on Thracian. I responded immediately that I would come to him at the Palace of the Inquisition the following morning. The second was from my old friend and colleague Titus Endor. It had been a long time since I had set eyes on him. His message, uncoded, read, "Gregor, my greetings to you. Are you home?" The brevity was disarming. I sent an affirmative response that was similarly brief. Endor clearly did not want to converse in writing. I awaited his response. The third was also uncoded, or at least lacked electronic encryption. It said in glossier, "Scalpel cuts quickly, eager tongues revealed. At Cadia, by Terse. Hound wishes thorn. Thorn should be sharp." The sea terrace was probably the main reason I had leased the ocean house in the first place. It was a long, ceramite-vaulted hall with one entire wall made of armoured glass looking into the ocean. The industrialization of Thracian Primaris had killed off a great part of the world's sea life, but at these depths, hardy survivors such as luminous deep anglers and schools of incandescent jellies could still be glimpsed in the emerald nocturnal glow. The candle-lit room was washed by a rippling green half-light. Yerat's servitors had set the long table for 9, and those 9 were already taking their seats and chatting over preprandial drinks as I arrived. Like most of them, I had dressed informally, putting on a simple black suit. The kitchen provided steamed fubi dumplings and grilled kettlefish, followed by seared haunches of rare gamey or kunu, and then pear and berry tarts with a cinnamon jus. A sturdy Gudrunite claret and sweet dessert wine from the vineyards of Messina complemented the food perfectly. I had forgotten the excellent qualities of the house Yarat ran for me, so far away from the hardship of missions in the field. Around the table with me were Amos, Bequin, Ravener, Von Baeg, my rubricator and scribe Aldemar Sulis, Yubal Kirscher, the head of household security, a trusted field agent called Harlon Nail, and Thula Surskova, who was Bequin's chief aide with the distaff. Medea Betancourt had chosen not to join us, but I knew the intensity of the piloting chores down through Thracian airspace had undoubtedly worn her out. I was pleased to see that Ravener was present. His injuries were healing, the physical ones at least, and though he was quiet and a little withdrawn, I felt he was beginning to come through the shock of Arianod's death. Surskova, a short, ample woman in her 40s, was quietly briefing Bequin on the progress of the newer distaff initiates. Amos chanted onto Sulis and Nail about the events on Lethe 11, and they listened intently. Sulis, enfeebled and prematurely aged by a wasting disease, never left the ocean house and devoted his life to the maintenance and preservation of my extensive private libraries. If Amos hadn't related the story of our last mission to him, I would have made sure I did. Such tales were his only connection to the active process of our business, and he loved to hear them. Nail, an ex-bounty hunter from Loki, had been injured on a mission the year before and had not been able to join us for the Lethe endeavour. He too lapped up Amos's account, asking occasional questions. I could tell he was itching to get back to work. Von Baeg and Kirscher chatted idly about the preparations for the Novena that was now gripping the hives of Thracian, and the security consequences they brought. Kirscher was an able man, ex-Arbetes, and dependable, if a little unimaginative. As dessert was served, the discussion broadened across the table.
"They say the bestowment will be the making of the Warmaster,"
Nail said, his loaded spoon poised in front of his mouth. "He's made already, I'd say," I retorted.
"Nail's right, Gregor. I heard that too,"
said Ravener.
"Feudal protector. That's as good as Imperial Lord Commander Helican admitting the Warmaster is on an equal footing with him."
"It's a sinecure."
"Not at all. It makes Honorius the favourite to become Warmaster-in-Chief in the Akrotara Theatre, now that Warmaster Hidju is dead, and Hidju was being groomed for a place on the Senatorium Imperialis, perhaps even to sit amongst the High Lords of Terra."
"Honorius may be Magnus, but he's not High Lord material," I ventured.
"After this he might be," said Nail. "Lord Commander Helican must think he has potential, or he wouldn't be giving him such an almighty hand up."
Politics left me cold, and I seldom empathized with political ambitions. I only studied the subject because my duties often demanded a detailed working knowledge. Imperial Lord Commander Helican, which is to say, Jeromir Fowlitz IV of the noble imperial family Fowlitz, was the supreme secular authority in the Helican subsector, for which reason he styled himself with the subsector's name in his appellation. On paper, even the cardinals of the Ministerium, the Grand Master of the Inquisition, the senior luminaries of the Administratum, and the Lords Militant had to answer to him, though, as with all things in imperial society, it was never as easy as that. Church, state, and military, woven together as one, yet constantly inimical. In favouring War Master Honorius with the bestowment, Lord Helicon was throwing his lot in with the military, an overt signal to the other organs of government, and clearly expected the War Master to return the favour when he rose to levels of government beyond those of a single subsector. It was a dangerous game, and rare for so senior an official to play openly for such an advantage, though the battle glory that surrounded Honorius made a perfect excuse. And that made it a dangerous time. Somebody would want to redress that balance. My money would be on the ecclesiarchy, though it's fair to say I'm biased. However, history has shown the church to be chronically intolerant of losing power to the military or the state. I said as much.
There are many other elements, Amos chuckled,
accepting a refill of dessert wine.
The Fowlitz line is weak and lacks both support in the Adeptus Terror and a ready ear at the Senatorum Imperialis and the courts of the Golden Throne. Two powerful families, the Divenzi and the Fulvatori, are seeking to make gains against the Fowlitz, and would take this as an open show of defiance. Then there's the House of Erstwald, who see their own famous son, Lord Militant Strephon, as the only viable replacement for Hidju. And the Augustan dynasty, let's not forget, who were ousted from power when the High Lord of Terra, Gian Augustin, died in office 40 years ago. They've been trying to get back in with feverish determination these last few years, pushing their candidate, Lord Commander Cosimo, with almost unseemly impudence. If Nail's right, and the bestowment makes Honorius a certainty as Hidju's successor, he'd become a direct competitor with Cosimo for the High Lord's vacant position.
Down the table, Beckwin yawned and caught my eye.
Cosimo's never going to make it,
Sulus put in candidly.
His house is far too unpopular with the Adeptus Mechanicus, and without their consent, however tacit, no one ever makes it to High Lord rank. Besides, the Ministerium would block it. Gian Augustin made no friends there with his reforms. They say it was a Calidus of the Officio Assassinorum, under orders from the Ecclesiarchy, that took old Gian off, not a stroke at all.
Careful what you say, old friend, or they'll be sending one after you, Ravenna said.
Sulus held up his bony hands in a dismissive gesture as laughter rippled around the table.
It is still most perturbatory, Amos said. This bestowment could lead to a house war. Quite apart from all the obvious opponents, Lord Helicon and the War Master could find themselves tasked by imperial families who are thus far neutral. There are many who are quite comfortable with their situation, and who would strike with astonishing ruthlessness simply to avoid being drawn into an open bloody clash.
There was silence for a moment.
Sulus, said Ravenna quickly, changing the subject with a diplomat's deftness. I have a number of works for you that I collected on Lethe, including a palimpsest of the Analecta Phenomena.
Sulus engaged the young interrogator eagerly. Amos, von Beg, and Nail continued to debate the imperial intrigue. Beckwin and Sir Scova made their good nights and withdrew. I took my crystal balloon of Amasek to the glass wall and looked out into the oceanic depths. Kersher joined me after a moment. He smoothed the front of his navy blue jacket and put on his black gloves before speaking.
We had intruders last month, he said quietly.
I looked round at him.
When?
3 times, in fact, he said.
Though I didn't realize that until the third occasion. During night cycle, about 6 weeks ago, I had what seemed to be a persistent fault on the alarms covering the seawall vents. There was no further sign, and the servitors replaced that section of the system. Then again, a week later, on the service entrance to the food stores and the outer doors of the distaff annex, both on the same night, I suspected a system corruption and planned an overhaul of the entire alarm net. The following week, I found the security code on the outer locks of the main door had been defaulted to 0. Someone had been in and left again. I scoured the building and found vox thieves buried in the walls of 6 rooms, including your inner chambers, and discrete far coders wired into 3 communication junction nodes, spliced to vox and pict lines.
Someone had also tried and failed to force their way into your void vault, but they didn't know the shield codes. And there were no traces. No prints, no microspores, no follicles. I washed the air myself through the particle scrubber. The in-house picked recorders show nothing, except a beautifully disguised time jump of 34 seconds. The astropaths sensed nothing. In one place, the intruder must have walked across 4 meters of underfloor pressure pads without setting them off. In retrospect, I realized the 2 prior incidents, far from being system faults, were experimental tests to probe, gauge, and estimate our security net. Trial runs before the actual intrusion. For that, they used a code scrambler on the main doors. If they'd actually been able to crack it, they could have reset the code, and I'd never have known they'd been in. You've double-checked everything. No more bugs to be found. He shook his head. Lord, I can only apologize, sir. I held up a hand. No need, Kersha. You've done your job. Show me what they left. Kersha unrolled a red felt cloth across the top of a table in the quiet of the inner library. He was nervous, and beads of sweat were trickling down from his crest-like shock of white hair. I hadn't wanted to alarm anyone, so I'd asked only Ravana and Amos to join us. The room smelled of teak from the shelves, must from the books, and ozone from the suspension field sustaining especially frail manuscripts. The felt was laid out. On it lay 9 tiny devices, 6 Vox Thieves and 3 Farcoders, each one set in a pearl of solid plastic. Once I'd stripped them out, I sealed them in inert gel to make sure they were dead. None were booby-trapped. Gideon Ravener stepped in and picked up one of the sealed Vox Thieves, holding it up in the light.
Imperial, he said. Unmarked, but Imperial. Very high grade and advanced.
I thought so too, said Kersha. Military? Secular? I asked.
Ravana shrugged. We could source them to likely manufacturers, but they likely supply all arms of the Imperium.
Amos's augmetic optics clicked and turned as he peered down at the objects on the cloth.
The Farcoders, he began. Similarly advanced. It takes singular skill to patch one of these successfully into a comm node.
It takes singular skill to break in like they did, I countered.
They have no maker markings, but they're clearly refined models from the Amplox series. Much more refined than the heavy-duty units the military use. It's just conjecture, but I'd say this was beyond the Ministerium, too. They're notoriously behind when it comes to tech advancements.
Who, then? I asked.
The Adeptus Mechanicus?
He ventured. I scowled. He shrugged, smiling.
Or at least a body with the power and influence to secure such advanced devices from the Adeptus Mechanicus.
Like?
The Officio Assassinorum?
Who would break in to kill, not listen.
Noted. Then a powerful imperial house, one with clout in the Senatorum Imperialis.
Possible, I admitted.
Or,
he said.
Or? Or the one imperial institution that regularly employs such devices and has the prestige and determination to make sure it is using the best available equipment.
That being? Amos looked at me as if I was stupid.
The Inquisition, of course.
I slept badly, fitfully. 3 hours before the end of the night cycle, I sat up in my bed, suddenly coldly awake. Dressed only in the sheet I had wrapped around me, I stalked out into the hall, my grip firm on the matte grey snub pistol that lived in a holster secured behind my headboard. Dim blue light filtered through the hallway, softening the edges of everything. I crept forward. I was not mistaken. Someone was moving about down below, in the lower foyer. I edged down the stairs, gun braced, willing my eyes to accustomize to the gloom. I thought to hit a vox and alert Kersha and his staff. But if someone was inside, skillful enough to get past the alarms, then I wanted to capture him, not scare him off with a full-blown alert. In the few hours since I had arrived back at the Ocean House, a nasty taste of treachery had seeped into my world. It might be largely paranoia, but I wanted an end to it. A beam of white light stabbed across the foyer floor from the half-open kitchen doors. I heard movement again. I sidled to the doorframe, checked the safety was off, and slid, weapon first, through the gap in the doors. The outer kitchen, a realm of marble-topped work bays and scrubbed aluminium ranges, was empty. Metal pots and utensils hung silently from ceiling racks. There was a smell of garlic and cooked herbs in the still air. The light was on in the inner pantry, near the cold store, and the illuminated backwash filled the room. Two steps. Three. Four. The kitchen's stone floor was numbingly cold under my bare feet. I reached the door to the inner pantry. There was movement inside. I kicked the door open and leapt inside, aiming the compact sidearm. Medea Betancourt, clad only in a long ex-military undershirt, roared out in surprise and dropped the tray of leftover kettlefish she had been gorging on. The tray clattered on the tiled floor in front of the open larder.
"Great God's alive, Eisenhorn!"
she wailed in outrage, jumping up and down on the spot.
"Don't do that!"
I was angry. I didn't immediately lower my aim. "What are you doing?"
"Eating, hello?"
she sneered at me.
"Feel like I've been asleep for a week. I'm famished."
I began to lower the gun. A sense of embarrassment began to filter into my wired state. "I'm sorry. Sorry. You should maybe get dressed before you come down to raid the larder." It sounded stupid even as I said it. I didn't realize how stupid until a moment later. I was too painfully aware of her long, dark legs and the way the singlet top was curved around the proud swell of her bust.
"You should take your own advice, Gregor,"
she said, raising one eyebrow. I looked down. I had lost the sheet, kicking open the door. I was what Midas Betancourt used to call very naked. Except, of course, for the loaded gun. "Damn. My apologies." I turned to scrabble for the fallen sheet.
"Don't stand on my account,"
she sniggered. I froze, stooped. The muzzle of a transverse parabellum was pointing directly at my head from the darkness behind me. It lowered. Harlan Nail looked me up and down for a moment in frank dismay, and then raised a warning finger to his lips. He was fully clothed. Damn him. I retrieved my sheet.
"What?"
I hissed.
"Someone's in. I can feel it,"
he whispered.
"The noise you two were making. I thought it was the intruder. Didn't know you were so keen on Medea."
"Shut up." The two of us fanned out back through the outer kitchen. Nail pulled up the hood of his vulcanized black body glove to cover his pale, shaved head. He was a big man, a head taller than me, but he melted away into the darkness. I watched carefully for his signals. Nail waved me left down the hall. I trusted his judgment completely. He had stalked the galaxy's most innovative and able scum for 3 decades. If they were intruders, he'd find them. I entered the Ocean House's main hall and saw the front entry was ajar. The code display on the main lock was blinking a default of zeros. I swung round as a gun roared behind me. I heard Nail cry out and sprinted back into the inner foyer. Nail was on the floor, grappling with an unidentified man. "Get up! Get up! I'm armed!" I shouted. In reply, the unknown intruder smacked Nail's head back against the floor so hard he knocked him out, and then threw Nail's heavy sidearm at me. I fired once and blew a hole in the wall. The spinning gun clipped my temple and knocked me over. I heard a series of fleshy cracks and impacts, a guttural gasp, and then Medea Betancourt's voice shouting, "Lights up!" I rose. She was standing astride the intruder, one hand braced in a fierce fist, the other pulling down her undershirt for modesty.
"I got him,"
she said, glancing round at me. The dazed intruder was clad in black from head to foot. I wrenched off his hood. It was Titus Endor.
"Gregor,"
he lisped through a bloody mouth.
"You did say you were home?"